Senate State Affairs to order. It is about 3.5 minutes after the hour. Present day, we have Senators Giesel, Coghill, and myself, Chair Dyson. It is our intention to hear first HB 130. Sorry, somebody here for HB 130. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And appreciate the committee hearing the bill today. House Bill 130, the idea was brought to me by Jim Reardon, a resident who many of you may know in my hometown of Homer, served in the served Alaska well for many years in fishing game and other things. We also have a series of pictures, but in the interest of time, I would just direct the committee that there is a there is a new series, which is oral history series, moderated by Dr. Terrence Cole from UAF, Alaska Statehood Pioneers in Their Own Words. And that's available on 360 North, and it's a very good series. And there's the ninth in the series, I believe it is the interview for a full hour with Jay Hammond throughout time. So I would just introduced with that, and then that House Bill 130. You know, Jay Hammond was born in 1922, and he served in World War II. He was a bush pilot, master trapper, hunting guide. He graduated from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. Representative Alaska here in the state of Alaska, two terms as governor, but also served in both houses of the legislature, and he was the mayor of the Bristol Bay Borough. The time that he served, he oversaw the construction of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, you know, the exploration on the North Slope, and the creation of the Permanent Fund. He worked very hard for a diversified Alaska economy in promoting healthy fisheries, conservation of land, and also agriculture, as well as the oil developments that took place. Again, he did work to establish the Permanent Fund and the Permanent Fund Dividend, which many Alaskans are very familiar with. Following his career in public service, which was involved many people, and many of the committee may be familiar with that career, he served with the Alaska Humanities Forum, the North Pacific Fisheries Convention Advisory Committee, Alaska Land Use Council, Alaska Airmen's Association, Veterans of Foreign Wars, the NRA, and he was named the Alaskan of the Year in 1994, and he received the University of Alaska Medal of Merit. And so we brought forward this bill because we thought it was very fitting to honor his legacy to Alaska by naming July 21st as in his legacy as J. Hammond Day.
What's significant about that date?
That is the date of his birth in 1922.
Yeah. All right. Thank you. Questions or comments from the committee? I suspect if time wasn't the essence, we could all tell lots of anecdotes about Jay. I met him sitting on a log above Bella's set-net site at Neck Neck Point. One time, he often flew back and forth to his home. And one time, in a distress call, somebody had nosed over on a bush airstrip. And he came in with, I think, twin engine aircraft that he often flew and landed and rescued the people and dropped them off at Lake Hill, at the village of Iliamna. And one of them said, "Sure appreciate you saving us. Did anybody ever tell you look a lot like the governor?" Yeah, I've heard that. Wave goodbye. Anyways, what's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move House Bill 130, version 28, LS0537-U from committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Is there objection? Seeing and hearing none, House Bill 130 is passed on to, I believe it will be to rules. It's no finance.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and thanks for bringing this forward. Next, we'll hear SB 73.
Good morning, Chair Dyson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Edra Morledge, staff to Senator Meyer. Before you should have a CS for SB 73 version C, which allows a municipal property tax exemption for widows and widowers of military service members. This new version is the result of several questions and concerns raised at the last hearing.
Senator Geisel, will you move the C version for us, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 73, version 28, LS0631-C, as the committee's working draft.
Objection? Seeing none, that is the bill before us. Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
As I mentioned, the new version is a result of some questions and concerns that were raised at the hearing on April 1st. I posed those questions to the Department of Law, and they prepared a memo, which you should have in your packets, which I think, we believe it answered all of the questions and concerns that were raised. We made two significant changes to the CS, which I think also addressed those concerns that members had. And if you'd like, I can walk you through those changes at this time. Okay, the first change is the language on page 1, lines 13 and 14, and continues on to page 2, lines 1 and 2. We changed that language to read, a resident who is the widow or widower of a person who dies from a service-connected cause sustained while serving as a member of the United States Armed Forces or as a member of the National Guard. And this addressed two of the major concerns. One was the term active duty. There is no definition in Alaska state statutes that defines what active duty means. There is a federal government definition which specifically excludes National Guard members, but we wanted them included in this legislation. So we removed active duty and defined it as a service-connected cause while serving. To include the National Guard as well. And then second of all, I believe that this language also clears up that the death must be service-related, not to be a suicide and not to be recreational or death incurred off-duty, such as a car accident or something similar. The second change is we added language on page 2, lines 12 through 13, to clarify that municipalities shall determine the eligibility requirements and application procedure for this optional exemption. This language was inserted at the suggestion of Senator Coghill, and we've heard positive feedback from the Fairbanks North Star Borough that this is a good change and allows them the tools that they need to administer the property tax exemption should their citizens ever vote to have a similar ordinance such as the municipality of Anchorage passed last year. We anticipate a new zero fiscal note, as we didn't make any changes that would cause the state to incur any fiscal liability. So with that, I'd be willing to answer any questions that the members might have.
I have questions at this time. I think some will come up. I have several people who want to testify. Most of them, they're here to answer questions. Senator Geisel and I live in the municipality of Anchorage, and we often hear about from municipal officials that the things we carve out on property taxes for hopefully deserving people causes budget concerns. And in that regard, I want to hear from Marty McGee, the assessor at the municipality of Anchorage. Can you hear us, Marty?
Yes, I can. Can you hear me?
Got you loud and clear. Please identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Marty McGee, I'm the assessor from the municipality of Anchorage. I'm primarily here to answer questions that you have. The municipality has no objection to this legislation as it's currently drafted, and my review of it indicates little, if any, fiscal impact from it. However, there's no accurate way for me to estimate the number of people that may qualify or to predict that as we look forward into the future for future tax years.
Thank you. I'm impressed that, I suspect we will see some applications from this, and I would enjoy whatever time period it takes you to assess this to give us a report on what the impact has been and the numbers. Thank you. Any questions for Marty? All right. Thanks, Marty. Want to hear now from Jeff Mittman in Anchorage. He's with the ACLU of Alaska. Go ahead, Jeff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is Jeffrey Mittman. I'm the Executive Director of the ACLU of Alaska. I believe the committee has our prior written testimony. Just very briefly to summarize that, I know time is of the essence. We have provided citations in our testimony to a case by the Alaska Supreme Court decided in 2007, AKCLU v. Alaska, in which the Alaska Supreme Court ruled that where the state provides benefits to a married opposite-sex couples, that it is unconstitutional based on the lowest level of scrutiny, a rational basis test, to deny those benefits to same-sex couples. Of note, the ACLU recently was involved in litigation at the trial court that applied this constitutional principle to the provision of benefits regarded to tax exemptions in municipal property taxation. That matter is currently up before the Alaska Supreme Court, and we are expecting the decision within the next 30 to 45 days. The upshot of this is that we'd simply request that the committee make a minor amendment to this bill so that it reflects the rulings of the Alaska Supreme Court and includes same-sex couples as is required by law. We would also note that with the advent of changes in the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, whereby military families who are in same-sex relationships, that their families are treated the same as other families to the extent permissible by law. We think it's a very easy amendment, and most importantly, it recognizes and honors the service of our veterans who are lesbian or gay. With that, I'm available to answer any questions.
Questions for Jeff? Jeff, I may have missed it in what you just said. If the court rules in favor of what you, the plaintiff, have the issue you've raised, I assume it would cover all of the law like this that gives benefits to married survivors. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, we believe legally it would. The issue comes up with the practicalities. In the past, when individuals have attempted to achieve benefits, unfortunately, there has also often been a lengthy litigation process. It's sometimes challenging for a municipal or state agency to do what the law requires without a specific court ruling. So absent an amendment by the committee in the wording of this bill, we would anticipate, based on past practice and past experience, that what would be required is a lengthy litigation to affect the rights that the Supreme Court has stated are necessary.
All right. Thank you. Questions for Mr. Bittman? I suspect, if indeed the court rules in the favor of ACLU on this case, I would encourage you to somewhat quickly and notify the Attorney General's Office or Department of Law and perhaps the Judiciary Committees, there might be indeed a cleanup bill that we could put this issue into. Thomas Dosik, Attorney General's Office. Can you hear us, Thomas?
Yes, I can.
All right. Would you comment on Mr. Mittman's issues he raises and any other that you think we should know about?
Unfortunately, I am not the subject matter expert on that portion of this bill. That attorney is not in the office at the moment. I drafted the memo regarding the questions that have been raised earlier, so I'm honestly not qualified to comment on what Mr.
All right. Is anybody here from the Department of Law that could shed any light on this? All right. Thanks for trying to help us out here, Thomas.
Chairman, this is Erling Johansson, Assistant Attorney General in Anchorage also.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, as Mr. Dosik pointed out, it's another one of our colleagues that deals with this specific issue. She's not available right now, but I think she was on the last hearing, sir.
All right. Please have that person comment on the specific question in the pending court case and the resulting actions if indeed the case is successful or the plaintiff is successful. And if we can do that sooner rather than later before this gets to the floor, that would be helpful. And thank you for your assistance. Next, I've got Scott Ruby. Can you hear us, Scott? Oh, I'm sorry. You're right. I missed that. Come on up, Scott. You're from Department of Commerce and DCRA.
Yeah. Sure, Dyson. My name is Scott Ruby. I'm the director for the Division of Community and Regional Affairs. One of our duties also is, under our division, is the state assessor that provides advice and assistance to municipal assessors and reviews their policies and practices. I was mainly here for questions, but I guess 2 points that I would like to bring up in previous discussion on this bill. It was asked about if municipalities had the ability to make policies and procedures, and to what extent could they decide how to enact this. Obviously, Section E is mandatory exemptions, but the way this is written within that subsection, it is an optional exemption that municipalities may adopt, and they may do it by ordinance. So there implies within that that they have some latitude in the ability of adopting that. Also, if you look at the statute, subsection F, immediately following this section, applies to this section that municipalities, it gives them specifically some more latitude on adopting policies and procedures and how people would apply for this exemption and timeframes and being able to make more specific this exemption. And I guess the final thing I would note is subsection E or subsection G, two subsections after this bill, does state that any exemption placed in E would be reimbursable by the state to municipalities for the cost, although it is subject to appropriation by the legislature. And in the legislature has chosen not to, in the past, recent past, be able to fund those exemptions. But that has been one thing that's come up that I'd like to point out.
Yeah. And thanks for pointing it out. Any questions, comments? Senator Coghill.
One of the things that I got immediately confused with, and maybe municipal boards would have to grapple with, and that is the section 030 and 050. It looks like they're compatible, but they would have now, it looks like, a menu of things that they could decide. Do you see the same compatibility that I understand?
Right. Through the chair, Senator Coghill. Yeah, that's the way we view that is a different variation of an exemption. It's close, but they have different parameters, and so that the municipality could choose which of those specifically they wanted to given the legislative or the statute and the ability to do an exemption. This has different parameters that they could adopt.
Mr. Chairman, the way I see it is, I can hear a debate in the municipal group on a different level for each one of these, and so that's something that I would anticipate. So, but that was my first reaction: is why do we want to do this? But this is a broader, still even yet, a much broader than 050. So, but I appreciate the fact that they get to determine now the eligibility requirements. All right.
And I appreciate, Chair Dyson, that it is permissive for the political subdivision, just as permissive for whether or not the legislature funds it. All right. Any other questions or anybody else in the audience cares to comment? Thank you. Any questions or comments from the committee? I'll entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 73, version 28LS0631, /C, from this committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal note.
Any objection? Seeing none, the bill is passed. We'll now take up 64. Senator Ellis.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Johnny Ellis, representing downtown and Mountain View neighborhoods in the Alaska State Senate. It's an honor to be with you this morning. I really appreciate you having this bill before us, and a special shout out to the Judiciary Committee for being the sponsor of this omnibus legislation. I'm going to make some very brief introductory remarks, and then we have some resource people here from the committee some other resource folks who will have some things to present in terms of the legislation. Let me just begin by saying, Mr. Chairman, that in terms of correction policy, Alaska truly is at a crossroads. And as lawmakers, we have an opportunity to follow the best minds in the country on corrections reform to confront Alaska's rising prison costs with an emphasis on public safety. I have come to the conclusion, as have many others who've delved into this in depth, that we can have both. It's not a trade-off. We can have both. I had an epiphany, Mr. Chairman, during my work on these issues. I've always been concerned about rising prison costs and the lack of treatment for mental health and substance abuse addictions in our corrections facilities, and how those housing the mentally ill and housing the addicted has not really contributed to public safety and has been at great public expense. I've delved into these issues, and I came across a website for a very conservative group called Right on Crime. I highly recommend that to you. It's national leaders like Newt Gingrich and Grover Norquist, some folks that I would not normally have a lot in common with politically. And I suspended my disbelief and my concern from a progressive viewpoint and read through their statement of principles and their views. And I said, Mr. Chairman, I agree with every single thing that these people are trying to accomplish. I considered that an eye-opening experience, a magic moment where progressives and conservatives can come together to do some very good work together, and that's the opportunity that lies before us today. Some very tough-on-crime conservative states like Texas, Kentucky, South Carolina have passed corrections reform legislation. This takes some work. It takes some coalition building and education of legislators, but this has been accomplished in some of the most conservative states in the country, and work is going on and discussions are going on in almost every state in the nation. So it is a movement, a national movement, that makes a whole lot of common sense. Senate Bill 64, the Alaska Public Safety Improvement Act, is designed to stem the tide of Alaska's climbing corrections costs, reduce recidivism, and increase public safety. Again, it's not a trade-off. It's called the Smart Justice Movement, and I'm proud that we're working together to bring this kind of enlightened thinking, cost-effective thinking, fiscally conservative thinking to the state of Alaska. So with that, Mr. Chairman, that's the goal that we're shooting for, increase public safety at lower cost. It was a wake-up call, I think, to all of us that after spending over $250 million for the Goose Creek Correctional Facility and $50 million in our budget on top of the existing corrections costs for that department, that we have to begin planning almost immediately for the next mega prison if we are to keep up with the trajectory of increase in incarceration in the state of Alaska. There has to be a better way in terms of protecting the public and protecting the public treasury. And that's the project. That's what I'm hoping we will work together on over the interim. And I really appreciate your attention to this major issue. Thank you.
Senator Ellis, information I've seen says that we in our state are incarcerating people at nearly the highest rate in the nation, and that our growth in prison correction population is in the top four or five. Do you have a, is that reasonably accurate?
I believe it is. Carmen Gutierrez will be with us online, and I believe she can verify that. We can get the very specific data for you, but I believe you're generally correct in that assessment.
Thank you. I respect your experience in this body. I think it is nearly the longest service we have. What, from the position of a State Affairs Committee, what are the policy issues that would be legitimate for this committee to be concerned about on this bill?
Mr. Chairman, I've thought mostly about the bill in terms of the work of the Judiciary Committee, so you're putting me on the spot a little bit for, I would need a minute to think that through.
Yeah, I think so too, and it is our intention and your co-sponsors that this we get this bill to Judiciary for work during the interim. Mm-hmm. Senator Giesel, would you move the backslash C for as our working draft?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 64, version 28, LS0116, backslash C, as the committee's working draft.
Any objection? Seeing none, I'm going to go off the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Chad Osten. I'm the staff for Senator Coghill. If the committee would so desire, I can go through each section and just kind of give an executive summary of what's in the bill. And then if any questions crop up, I'd be happy to answer them. Or Carmen Gutierrez could be online. And we also have Nancy Mr. Mead.
Chairman. Senator Coghill.
Mr. Chairman, I think if you go briefly through there, the policy calls that would probably fall into the state affairs category are going to be the driver's license issues. And there are two provisions in here for conditional driver's license. And I would, when we have testimony, you'll see that that is going to be one of the key questions that we'll have to answer along the way. So, and I think we can probably go through it fairly briefly.
Yes.
All right. And I think Senator Ellis has fairly eloquently said what the mission that we're after here, and perhaps you could kind of outline us how this piece of legislation moves us forward towards accomplishing that mission.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I'll attempt to do that to the best of my ability. It moves us forward in a number of different ways. The two specific reasons that are most prevalent in the bill are the establishment of the Alaska Sentencing Commission, which is found in Section 2, it has various members of the Senate and the House. It has public safety. It has HESS involved. And it basically is going to look to make recommendations and do the analysis with regards to improving sentencing practices for defendants. They're going to review statutes. They're going to analyze the rules. They're going to look at the effectiveness. So that's the Alaska Sentencing Commission. That's in Section 2. The other main portion of the bill deals with therapeutic courts and treatment programs and limited license for misdemeanors and felons. That's the remainder of the sections, effectively. Section 1 briefly discusses credit for the time when the defendant is in a treatment program. Section 3 discusses the termination of the revocation with regards to DUIs or refusals. And essentially what it states is if the person successfully completes a court-ordered treatment program and has good behavior and is successfully driven under a limited license for a period of time, the revocation will terminate. So that gives people incentives, essentially, to go through the therapeutic program and obtain limited license with the intention of speeding up the process for the termination of the regular license. Section 4 outlines when a court may grant limited license privileges, they have to be associated with a DUI or a refusal. A person has to participate in a court-ordered treatment program. The limited license minimum period is either for the time of the revocation if there is if they're a misdemeanant, which is 90 days, or 1 year for first-time offenders or second-time offenders. It can be more depending on what the time frames are for third- and fourth-time offenders. It could fall out of the felony provisions in theory, and if that's the case, it would be 3 years or 5 years. And for people convicted of a felony, so that's three times within 10 years, the limited license provisions have to at least be for 5 years, and then the expectation is that the termination of the revocation of the license will be eliminated after that five-year period, which is a better deal for felons than what currently exists, which is, you know, a lifetime revocation with the presumption they can petition in 10 years to get their license back, which they may or may not be able to go through with. And the court may or may not grant that. They have to also provide proof of insurance, that stay free from drugs and alcohol, and they have to do regular testing for substances. Section 5 outlines the procedure briefly. Basically, the person pleads no contest or guilty, and the court may provide incentive for completing the treatment program, and they may have a reduction in fine, they may have a reduction in the incarceration period or the license revocation. The intent of all this is to encourage folks to take advantage of the treatment programs available to get their regular license back, and at the same time receive treatment which will be helpful for them, helpful for their families, and helpful for society in general. Sections 6 and 7 was actually taken from the previous SB 81, and that deals specifically with a policy call related to felons. Felons can get their license back, in theory, as I mentioned before, if they can petition the court within 10 years, even though technically it's a lifetime revocation. But under the programs that we're proposing, the court shall restore the license if they've completed the treatment program, if they've successfully driven on the limited license, if they've stayed away from drugs and alcohol, and they're financially responsible. So that's a major incentive for a felon, you know, or what's deemed as chronic offenders within a short period of time. That applies for both DUI and refusals. Sections 8 and 9 establish a program for certain offenders and for the parole board, and it basically requires random drug testing and requires the probation officer or the parole officer to file a petition if the person is found to be in violation for drugs or alcohol for whatever reason. So there is some protections in place. From a policy standpoint, that's a good idea to have a continuing program where they can do random drug testing, they can monitor this to make sure these people are adhering to the provisions that the court has required. So that's the bill as far as an executive summary goes. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them. And we also have Carmen Gutierrez, who was one of the architects of most recently our CS. And she's got a wide berth of knowledge to draw from. We also have Nancy Mead, that she will be available at a point in time to answer questions today.
Questions or comments? I have several people would like to testify. Tiffany Thomas from DMV, driver's licensing. Can you hear us, Tiffany?
Yes, sir, I can. Thank you.
All right. Please identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Tiffany Thomas. I'm the driver licensing manager for the Division of Motor Vehicles. My office oversees both the termination of revocations and the limited licenses that are issued by the Division of Motor Vehicles. The division has reviewed the bill. I was just now reading the latest update, so I'm still working my way through that. But I just wanted to provide some background information and answer any questions that the committee may have. But for background purposes, the DMV processes the terminations of revocations for both the DMV administrative actions and the court revocations, because the court doesn't have access to our DMV driving records. So once the revocations are modified by a DMV hearing officer, the court signs off that they agree to the modification of the revocation, and then the applicant can then reinstate to the division to get their license back. My cursory glance through the most, that the CS appears to have alleviated the concerns that I had pertaining to the felony termination process. So I'll skip ahead to Section 4 regarding the issuance of a limited license. In most cases, the actions that are on a person's driving record run consecutive to one another, so they compound and they build with each offense that the person is convicted of. In my experience as a former hearing officer, this is especially true of most of the drivers who are convicted of felony DUI, such as those who may be participants in the wellness court. So what that means for this bill is that by the time the person's convicted of their felony DUI, they may already be revoked for 10 years or more before they can even get to that revocation for wellness court. It appears as though the bill as currently worded would allow the person in wellness court to drive on a limited license, even though they may still be revoked or suspended for another offense, either by the court or through an administrative action. So I just wanted to call that to your attention. Another issue I'd like to point out regarding the limited licenses that are issued by the court is that the court is not, they don't have access to the DMV driving record. So this means that they're not going to be able to annotate or update the person's driving record to reflect that this person may be on a limited. They're going to be issued a piece of paper that they will have to carry around with them. The problem is potentially if they're pulled over by law enforcement and they present this piece of paper to law enforcement, when law enforcement is pulling them up in the database, their DMV driving record is still going to show that they are suspended or revoked. Another issue is that DMV only has the authority to issue limited licenses for DUIs, and that's under 2815. Since the wellness court works with the felony DUIs and the refusals, the DMV wouldn't have the authority it would need to issue a limited license to a person, even if the driver showed up at DMV with a court order. The DMV also would like to point out that it wasn't quite clear, at least in my first glance. I'll have to go back and review the CS to see if it was touched on, but if a limited license, under the limited license section, if they would also be required to have an ignition interlock device, which is a standard requirement for the non-felony misdemeanor DUI refusal limited. So thank you for allowing me an opportunity to point these issues out. I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Yeah, thank you. Do you have any sense of what the impact on your budget might be of adding this other category?
Mr. Chair, there's a zero fiscal note attached to this.
All right. Thank you. Any questions or comments?
Just a comment, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Coghill.
I think she brings up some good points. We've always struggled with the communication connection between the courts, DMV, and public safety. So maybe in this bill we can create a pathway that makes that work better. So, because I think that's a legitimate point, and we need to make sure that if we're going to move forward on accountability measures, that everybody knows what that accountability measure is clearly and quickly. So that's a very good point.
Yeah, and I would suggest that amongst this task force responsibility to look at the barriers to that kind of communication. When I got here, the corrections Department of Law folks had to have two computers sitting on their desk. Mm-hmm. They would look at one and enter the data to the other one. And only government can be constrained like that, but probably legislators refuse to appropriate money to solve that problem. All right. I'm looking here. Quinn, are you, Steiner, are you on? Can you hear us, Quinn?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. This is Clement Steiner. I'm the public defender for the state of Alaska. Mostly I wanted to put myself on, make myself available for questions. I would comment that this bill does open up opportunities for treatment and provide quite a bit of incentive to participate in treatment. As you probably know, the vast majority of people who are incarcerated get out at some point, and treatment opportunities, incentive to do treatment opportunities, will promote public safety. I mean, folks who have an opportunity to take care of their issues that led them here who have the opportunity to get out from the system, and I think this bill does that. But I'm happy to answer any questions.
Yeah, there's lots of questions, but I think they're more properly issued in the Judiciary Committee, and I suspect you would be glad to participate and help that group in the future. Certainly for me, and maybe there's a short-term solution, but I worry about parole violators that violate on relatively technical things, administrative things, and then end up having their parole revoked and serving their sentence serially. And difficulty of a person without a driver's license to be able to get to the places they need to be and so on. And offline we can visit about if there's any intermediate things to fix that. All right, please stand by. I'm going to go to now to Carmen Gutierrez. Can you hear us, Carmen?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman. This is Carmen Gutierrez for the record. I'm here available to testify from the Anchorage LIO.
Go.
All right. Thank you, sir. First of all, thank you very much for the opportunity to offer a few brief comments on what on the importance of SB 64 and its CS. As Senator Ellis so well stated, I believe that with this bill, Alaska has a real opportunity to look at proven best practices that may more effectively address criminality in our state, reduce recidivism, and in turn build healthier, safer Alaska communities. And I'd like to touch on just a few reasons why the time is really ripe for Alaska to take this new course and direction with the creation of an Alaska Sentencing Commission. Although it is not well publicized, crime in Alaska has actually decreased. According to the Department of Public Safety Uniform Crime Report for 2011, all violent crime index offense totals and property crime index offense totals decreased in 2011. The crime rate, which relates the incidence of crime to population, also experienced similar decreases. Yet, with actual decreases in the commission of violent and property crimes within our state, Alaska's prison population continues to grow by 3% per year. Since 2005, the hard bed prison population and the hard bed costs the state $135 per day per bed grew from 4,200 inmates to 4,961 inmates in 2012. At this current rate, DOC's inmate population is estimated to reach over 6,000 inmates in just hard beds by 2012. And so, for the reasons this, I think, proves what Senator Ellis referred to just a moment ago, which is, if we continue to grow at our current rate, we really need to start talking about building Alaska's next big prison today.
Carmen, I think you may have misspoke. You said we're going to get to the 6,000 by 2012, and
I'm sorry, 2020.
2020, yeah. Okay, thank you. Please continue.
Thank you. I'm sorry. Thank you for pointing out that error. So so the goal is, and we're really, I think, strategically poised, just like the state of Texas was in 2007. In 2007, Texas was at the same kind of crossroads. It was either looking at the millions and millions of dollars that it was going to take to continue to increase hard bed prisons, or they had an opportunity to look at more cost-effective ways that would actually be more effective in reducing criminality, reducing recidivism, and they succeeded. Evidence, Texas today is touted across the United States for what it has actually achieved here by 2013. They have avoided $2 billion in projected DOC expenses. Their recidivism rate has dropped, and not only has their recidivism rate dropped, but so has their crime rate within their state. And it is simply because Texas made a commitment to figure out how to do business in a more smart and cost-effective method. And they went out, they looked at the research, and they found, bottom line, that providing effective treatment programs for their offenders who have substance abuse problems was going to be the most single cost-effective thing they could do to reduce recidivism, and they implemented those programs, and in doing so, they've achieved these very, very noteworthy outcomes. I would finally like to say that this legislature has taken great efforts to increase DOC's budget for substance abuse treatment within its facilities and within the community. And I am hopeful that as we move forward through 2013 and into 2014, we're going to start to see some very positive results from the commitment that our legislature has made to funding these programs. But as of the best numbers that we had for 2011, our prison population rates were increasing. And in 2010, according to the research that was done, Alaska's prison population was growing. Our population nationwide was the 12th fastest DOC population. I think it's also important to note that the majority of Alaska's criminal statutes were rewritten in 1982. Alaska's criminal code was obviously based upon the best research at that time, but clearly, research has continued to advance over the last 29 years, and much has been learned about more effective ways to address criminality in a manner that actually reduces recidivism. And so with this sentencing commission, we have a real opportunity to take advantage of some of this best research and figure out more cost-effective, recidivism reduction-minded approaches to reducing criminality in our state. The Department of Law recently testified that the current criminal laws on the books are not working and that something has to be done about the number of people that we have incarcerated. And I am very hopeful that with CS-SB 64, we can move into a new direction that will make Alaska's communities safer and healthier. Thank you very much, and I'm available to answer any questions.
Questions for Carmen? I've run out of vocabulary to tell you how much we appreciate your help.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, but as an Alaskan who's lived here all my life, practiced law here, worked for the Department of Corrections, it is truly my greatest honor to assist your committee and the judiciary in these very important issues facing our great state. So it is truly my honor, and I am grateful for this opportunity.
Yeah, thank you. Go now to Janet McCabe. Can you hear us, Janet?
Yes, hello. Good morning, and I'm speaking for Partners for Progress. Since 19 when the Anchorage Municipal Prosecutor and Judge James Wanamaker and Partners for Progress started the first therapeutic court for DUI offenders in Alaska. We and others here today in Juneau and elsewhere have been working to increase Alaska's use and appreciation of smart justice. And in doing so, you and we have been part of a national movement to reduce America's waste of public and human resources through excessive incarceration. The basic concept of smart justice is to use our very limited public funds strategically and smartly to maximize public protection without squandering them on the highly expensive and often unnecessary tool of incarceration. The committee substitute of SB 64 before you is an excellent step towards achieving that goal. And here I will skip all I was going to say about Texas and Representative Jerry Madden, because you are familiar with that, and Carmen did a fine job of summarizing it. But I'd like to mention that at that time, Senator Dyson had mentioned that by doing the smart thing, not just the tough thing, Alaska can create similar economies and public safety improvements. And I'm so glad we're continuing that effort and are here today together. I do want to highlight briefly sections 3-7 of the proposed committee substitute. And I want to thank the bill sponsor, Senator John Cogill, for his clear sectional analysis of this complex topic. These five sections in the committee substitute create a way for the successful participants in a court-ordered treatment program to drive on a limited license as a pathway to getting a full license. In the classic smart justice format, these sections recognize the reality of the defenders of the DUI offender's addiction, as well as the reality of everyday life in an Alaskan community without the ability to drive. So the five provisions have sort of three main categories of beneficial effects. First, the opportunity to drive legally will be a powerful incentive, encouraging more DUI offenders to opt into the difficult 18-month court-ordered treatment program. Right now, those programs are below capacity, and there's need for a real, they are so tough that there is a need for an effective incentive, like the limited license with a long-term opportunity for a real license. More people opting into therapeutic courts will result in more occasions where an expensive prison term is replaced by a far less costly community-based treatment program. Further, participants in therapeutic courts receive a multidimensional, specialized type of addiction treatment that is designed to break the all-too-common pattern of recycling again and again through the prison system. A second group of benefits is that with a license, even a limited license, the possibility of employment is greatly enhanced. Employers will benefit from employees who are highly motivated to succeed in holding a job and to remain drug and alcohol free. Successful employment is in itself a powerful way to treat addiction. When one individual becomes self-sufficient, a self-sufficient lawful member of the community, there are numerous beneficial ripple effects for families, for children, and for the whole community and the state. And thirdly, the requirement for ongoing testing for abstinence from drugs and alcohol before being rewarded with a full license is also very smart justice. It's based on scientific evidence which indicates that recovery from severe drug and alcohol addiction is stabilized after 4 or 5 years of sustained abstinence. The committee substitute puts this system in place and motivates compliance with sanctions and with the powerful incentive of gaining a full license after driving successfully on a limited license. In conclusion, Partners for Progress welcomes the committee substitute for SB 64 as an important step forward towards criminal justice system reform that solves problems and reduces excessive incarceration. And thank you very much for the opportunity to testify on this important subject.
Well, thank you, Janet. I appreciate the work you've done over a long period of time to have a very significant impact. Any questions or comments on Janet's testimony? Senator Giesel.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's maybe not specifically on Janet's testimony, but just the concept in general. you know, my district had that incident that occurred a few years ago where the woman who had chronic alcohol issues was driving, had a head-on by Putter Marsh, killed someone. Now multiple layers of people knew she was inebriated. She still had access to a vehicle. She'd been through the court system several times. I know that there are outliers, but I have to bring that up because sure. The residents of my district were really upset that that occurred. So I believe she's actually incarcerated now. But I'm hoping that it doesn't get to that point ever again with another person.
Don't we all, Senator Coghill?
Yeah, we probably won't be able to stop all of them from happening. But what I think what we would do here is give the courts the capacity to say, you have to blow twice a day in order to have a license. That creates that public safety. It actually is victim protection in that regard. So I think you're going to see that view continually brought forward. So probably the question that's going to come before us along the way is, have we put enough money into the specialty courts to make sure that happens? And I think that's one of the questions that's going to arise, I think, significantly along the way. But even with felons who may be able to drive, the victim protection part of that is going to be they have to have insurance. Right now they're going to drive, and they're doing damage already. So this gives random testing with at least they have to have economic stability and insurance. So there are things that we're trying to do to protect the public as well as let them be productive. Yes, I agree that that has to continually stay in our focus.
All right. The other person we have online here is my good friend Jeff Mittman, ACLU. You're still online, Jeff?
Mr. Chair, I am. This is Jeffrey Mittman with the ACLU of Alaska, and I simply want to echo the comments in our correspondence, which is we support this bill and appreciate its introduction, the committee's consideration. We think a sentencing commission could be very helpful to the state's sentencing scheme. With that, I'm available to answer any questions.
Questions for Jeff? Perhaps I misspoke when I said good friend, but certainly friend, and appreciate your efforts. Any other?
Yeah, we would say good friend as well.
Okay. Anybody else wants to testify? All right. I'm going to make a couple of comments. There are some things I'm not quite sure as clear as I would like in the kind of the mission statement. And that is for them to particularly look at the process for expungement of the felony. Maybe that's not the right term, but a clear process that works as appropriate on folks who have had a conviction, having it, if not set aside, at least the effects, as in can't vote, can't hunt, can't get a permanent fund dividend, can't get lots of different kinds of employment, and so on and so forth. And I don't know how to work that out, but other states have done. I've seen some legislation going through their systems, so on. I think it's really a priority. 10 years ago, Representative Berkowitz and I worked on restorative justice, and one of the things we did to say that all of the assets of the perpetrator are up for grabs when it comes to restoring the victim to a pre-offense condition. And in talking with the people in the Department of Law, they certainly go after things for which there's a public record, but literally it's a research job sitting at a computer terminal, and I'm concerned that there are lots of other assets that some of the perpetrators have that ought to go to the benefit of the victim. And I would like the task force commission, if you will, on that. Also, I understand that many people on probation serve their full sentence serially. And I'm quite familiar with the therapeutic courts where their very strict obedience to the court's order leads to progressive freedom and so on and so forth. And balancing that against the folks that get disqualified for probation violations that are kind of related to transportation, you know, not being able to get where they've got to do their chemical testing and evaluations and so on and so forth. And then there's some hint here, but the impact of over-sentencing and the impact on a family who may breadwinner, maybe locked up, and the children who are deprived of a mother or a father, and other barriers to reentry, but the social cost or estimated social cost, and how that plays into the over sentencing. I know some people on the Judiciary Committee, but I'll probably write these things down and maybe so that we don't forget them. Any other? Please, come up.
Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. And I wanted to go on record, as I worked with the sponsor's office and staff on this bill, to say that the Alaska court system supports the sentencing commission that's described in Section 2 of this bill. Our Chief Justice is enthusiastic about making the appointments and having the opportunity to serve and appoint one judge at the appellate level and at the superior at the district court to participate in the committee. Normally the court doesn't support or oppose bills, but that is something that the Supreme Court isn't enthusiastic about. So I wanted to be sure that was on the record. As for the other sections of the bill, again, I did work with the sponsor's office and will continue to do so. As you know, the courts also embrace our therapeutic courts and believe that those are very solid smart justice programs. And these provisions came out of a subcommittee originally of the Criminal Justice Working Group, which had the Driving with License Suspended Subcommittee, which had representation from the Department of Law, the Department of Corrections, and the court system, as well as therapeutic courts and judicial counsel. And there is recognition that people without driver's licenses have a hard time living in our society, getting to work, getting to their probation appointments, getting their tests done as ordered. And it's a difficult problem. This is one solution, and it would be a step towards addressing the problem we have with an ever-increasing number of cases filed with charges for driving with license suspended and revoked. So those provisions are certainly within the legislature's policy purview to decide whether to adopt or not, but the court is prepared and will willingly implement them if adopted. And I'm available for any questions on any sections of the bill.
Thank you. Questions for Nancy?
Mr. Chairman, that was a big deal. That was a breakthrough there. So congratulations. Thank you very much for your support of the Sentencing Commission.
Yeah, I'm hoping that the administration and its many related departments will be enthusiastic about this for all the right reasons. Any other questions, comments from the committee? People want to testify? All right, what's the will of the committee?
Mr. Chairman, I move committee substitute for Senate Bill 64, version 28LS0116-C from this committee with individual recommendations and attached zero fiscal notes.
Is there objection?
A new fiscal note came in. I'll amend that motion to say the attached fiscal note, letter 64-A.
Thank you. Is there still no objection? Seeing none. I'm going to pass Senate Bill 64 on to the Judiciary Committee. Thank all the people that are working on this. My guess is you're on the side of the angels. We're adjourned.